This episode of The Stack was first broadcast on the 1st of November 2014 on Monocle 24.
Bedonian bold or refined Roman, new or otherwise, a preference for serifs or perhaps sans, text that is transitional or modern, and finding the font that fits, leaded, tightly kerned, cursive, or comic. Typeset the old way or created on screen. We go to the foundry and look very closely at the shape of print. Today on edition 114 of The Stack. This week on The Stack, we have a typographic special as we investigate that vital facet of print that should never be overlooked. What are words if they cannot be read? And how can the humble font reflect upon your brand and create a vision? Has digitization opened a Pandora's box of paltry printing, or are the opportunities for typographers more boundless than ever? We'll discuss all of that with two of the most talented men in the field. Plus, we'll speak to our own in-house talent and discover how Monocle magazine treats those tricky typographic dilemmas.
It's a bit like being a fashion house, and every season you have to reinvent yourself, but still you have to come out of the box looking like Chanel or Gucci, and it's not like one season Gucci are tartan and the next season they're about PVC onesies.
All that and plenty more besides on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé, to kick off this insider's guide that will hopefully be of interest to those non-typographically trained listeners. Bruno Mag hails from one of the heartlands of typography, Switzerland, where he began his career with an apprenticeship as a typesetter for the Tages-Anzeiger newspaper, the country's largest daily. He then went on to the influential New York foundry Monotype before establishing Dalton Mag here in London in 1991. Bruno's work is as prolific as it is disciplined, and past clients even include our very own Monocle magazine. And I'm also very happy to be joined by Adrian Shaughnessy, graphic designer and writer based in London. He is a senior tutor in visual communication at the Royal College of Art and a founding partner in Unit Editions, a publishing company producing books on design and visual culture. Unit Editions have just launched their newest tome, the rather lovely Type Plus, which we have right here. Adrian, I wanted to start with this volume, which is sitting here, quite a hefty tome. Tell us a little bit, we all go to lovely art bookshops and wonderful design shops around the world. Many would say, do we need another book on typography? Clearly the answer is yes. What does this deliver to the coffee table or to the art director's desk that perhaps other books aren't delivering?
Well, a good question. I think it's a particular look at an aspect of typography that I think is very prevalent. It's also a companion volume to a book we did a year ago called Type Only, where we looked at people who were using typography on its own. No illustrations, no pictures, just pure typography and the ability to express quite complicated messages and, I suppose, enhance a message through pure type. Mm. This looks at the other end of that spectrum. This looks at what you do with type when you embellish it, distort it, modify it. And I think it also, what's its value? Why do we need another book on typography? I think what it does is it shows a movement that's underway where typography is almost obsessed and fixated over at the expense of other modes of communication. Mm.
And how instructive is it? Because as you go through, I think what's interesting, you look at, and you mentioned distortion and sort of multiple contexts that the type is used within. So how instructive is it? And because obviously you have a lead into this. Everything that you're displaying here is something that you admire, or is it instructive that we're also saying that not everyone is a fantastic example?
I kind of like everything in there, although there are things that really challenge our sense of what is beautiful and what is elegant. I mean, there's some things in there that are definitely ugly, but for me, they say something. They catch the zeitgeist. They're reflective of what's happening in amongst particularly a young and crucially international audience. I mean, some of the work in there is from countries that you would not imagine are producing trendy, super graphic design, but they are.
Yeah.
I mean, really interesting.
Bruno, great to see you. It's been a while as
well.
I mean, aside from just the few minutes we've been on air. Tell me, I guess you just gave a little bit of a CV, but what has been keeping you you busy? Because it's been a few years since we've seen you.
Indeed, it's been particularly the major brand projects, you know, the work we have done with Nokia, the work we have done with Intel and HP. That's really been the big ones that have kept us alive and kicking, if you wish, you know, and challenged as well, particularly with Nokia, where we have created the phones for all the various writing systems. I think it was 19 altogether or something. So covering most of the languages in the world.
And just on that note, because it's been, you know, 2 weeks where we've heard that this is a name that's going to go away. Will that font world, though, continue with the new Microsoft regime?
Not with Microsoft, no. Actually, the Nokia group have kept hold of the IP on the fonts, and they're going to be using it in the maps, in the Nokia maps, you know, which is here.com. Now.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Just, I want to talk editorially, though, because you're talking about corporate work. I'm wondering, at a time, Bruno, when so many major media organizations are under the gun right now and are looking to save, etc., would you say that, you know, most of your work, you know, veers to the corporate right now, as opposed to sort of getting a phone call from a German newspaper or an Italian newspaper saying, hey, we've got a redesign coming up. We're not just going to buy something off the shelf. We'd like Bruno Magg to work on our typography for us.
It's always been corporate work for us, really. For some reason, we've never got our hands on editorials, although we have been actually talking to a Swiss newspaper recently. But yeah, for some reason, they don't seem to be able to make that step to actually commit, you know, because for a newspaper or publisher in a magazine, it is a big investment something that has to be considered very carefully.
And for people who are listening, and I'm not sort of asking you to give away lots of state secrets, but I'm sure lots of people are sort of listening going, yeah, where are things moving right now? Because obviously, I think the book is probably a manifesto in one way. It's not necessarily a commentary on where we are this moment. Broad question. But where do you think we are right now?
Well, it's a broad...
And I guess I'm thinking about from handcrafted and hand cut to obviously what we can do on a screen like that one in front of us.
Yeah. Well, I think there's two aspects to it. We're in an age of rampant eclecticism. I mean, people are free now, both as clients and designers, to pretty much do what they want. But I think there's another thing that, and Bruno is probably a better person to talk about this than I am, but this sort of sense of which I think is what drives the corporations, this need to own everything that they do. And I think that, for me, is an extraordinary thing. There's a problem in it in that it leads to a kind of uniformity, because there are only so many ways you can design the basic alphabet. I mean, there are only so many ways you can do it. So it worries me that we have this obsession with customized bespoke typefaces. And oddly enough, in a way, it leads to conformity. And I think you have to go to places like Cambodia and Thailand and to see what, you know, South America, Mexico, to see what's happening. So these are, for me, are two extremes. There's also the whole area of sort of cultured typographic thinking, which has never gone away. And you know, I guess you guys do it at Monocle. You know, it's a very considered approach, and there are other very many examples. Bruno's got some here. But I think those are the two extremes, the sort of pure experimental, pushing it as far as it will go, and then this sort of corporate conformism that's taking over.
We're going to hear from our Richard Spencer Powell, our creative director, a little bit later. He was talking to our producer, David Pleasant, but that'll be a little bit after the break. But Bruno, on that point about Nokia and sort of the various sort of worlds that you design for them, is that a... You know, would you say that as a client, which is few and far between, do you think there's a peculiarity that maybe it's more of a European company versus a US corporation that would be looking for things like that? And as you look across the horizon, do you worry, you know, in this everything, there can be so much excitement about, let's say, you know, a brand like Facebook or something, where you look at sort of the user interface, you go, did anyone really consider any of this? Not particularly beautiful. How do you sort of view that when, you know, your main gigs are corporate ones?
It is definitely the case that, you know, usability and user interfaces, and just generally, I think the human being isn't actually considered at all. You know, and unfortunately, I have to say, we do live under the curse of Helvetica. Everything has to be like Helvetica. It's unbelievable. If you look at the recent, you know, font that Apple has published, you know, for the new user interfaces, or the Google font. It's just kind of like a Helvetica similarity, and it comes back to what you said, Adrian, about the uniformity, and that's exactly the problem. No one dares to break out of that jacket somehow. And it is refreshing when you can see work coming out of South America, you know, where they're not that kind of like jaded yet,
yeah.
I suppose. Some refreshing work, you know, using typography that is slightly different, you know, that tries to experiment a little bit more.
I think you've hit an interesting point, the whole digital question, because I think that's another major driver. If you're going to create typography, you're going to create a font, you're almost certainly going to have to make it work digitally. So I think that leads to its own limitations and restraints and restrictions.
Indeed, I mean, certainly what we have experienced is now that digital is the primary purpose and print is secondary.
And I guess then there's the other side too. So you mentioned Apple. So of course, you know, everyone sort of knows that they're probably working on, you know, one of the most elaborate, expensive world headquarters as well. So, you know, when we talk about that conformity as well, Adrian, to you first, I mean, how much of it also would you say is driven still by the built environment, the aesthetics of a company? Also, you know, I'm not sure how involved the architects might get, but, you know, listen, if you're spending a lot of money, whether it's on Lord Foster or Zaha Hadid, they might have some type of say in terms of the fonts that are going to direct people to the washroom.
Yeah. Well, there's a famous link, isn't there, between architecture and typography. And architects are always interested in typography. Michael Bayrout has a great saying. He says, when you're working for architects, choose a typeface that was designed by an architect, or if it's not been designed by an architect, say it's been designed by an architect, and it always gets selected. So I think the relationship is really just, I don't know how many architects you'd want choosing your typefaces, though. I
mean, many would say, how many architects do you actually want to do the interiors and choose the sofa?
Yeah.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, I would never, ever trust an architect to do the typography. They're notoriously bad at it.
They're good at lettering, though. I mean, I always like the... I don't know if they even still do it. I probably don't anymore. But they used to see lettering on architectural blueprints, and they're usually beautiful.
Mm. Gentlemen, we're going to go just away for a very, very short break. You're listening to The Stack today. My guests, Adrian Shaughnessy and also Bruno Mugg. We're going away for a short break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to our creative director, Richard Spencer. I was going to be talking to our David Pleasant right after this.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and also my special guests today, Adrian Shaughnessy and Bruno Mugg. Now, we could not possibly have a discussion on fonts without looking at the work that is done every day in this very building, as production week for issue 79 draws to a close. Our producer, David Pleasant, managed to tear our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, away from his desk to have something of a mini masterclass on the do's and don'ts of treating type at Monocle.
So, Rich Spencer Powell, thanks for joining us. Firstly, I want to start. The font choice of Monocle is something quite kind of important. It's something that other people externally look at and sort of point as a sort of success in terms of the way the magazine looks. Can you tell us what that choice was and how it's used every day?
You're right in saying it's an important decision. It is, and it's particularly so in our case because the font that we chose is also part of the wordmark. So the word Monocle and the primary font used in Monocle are the same thing. They are typeface planting, which is an old Dutch typeface. And it was chosen for various reasons. Firstly, it's been designed for newspaper use, so it works well small. It's often said about planting that it holds ink well, and that's quite important. It just means that it gives you an increase in legibility, I think. The second reason is, although typography and design is, you know, it's a studied subject, there's a bit of science to it almost, it's also art. And sometimes I think people forget that people decide things in design on aesthetic values, simply because you like it. It's
it's a favourite of mine, and that's why it was kind of first out the box when we thought about designing Monocle.
It's got a kind of nice feeling about it. How can we put it into words what plantain is and how it's how it feels?
It's just, it's nice. It's a lovely, nice, warm font. And it's a serif font, we should add there. And a lot of serif fonts can be a little bit haughty and spiky, and they can feel very old and superior. And I think with plantain, it's something to do with the weights of it, that it's just a little softer, it's just a little bit warmer. And that's what I absolutely love about it. I wrote about it once saying that, like Helvetica, when you type a word in plantain, it almost feels like it's a logo. So the other typeface which we use primarily is Helvetica, which of course everyone knows Helvetica, but we kind of played around a little bit with how we used it. So plantain was the main typeface and Helvetica was just this little modern bit on the side. And part of the thinking of that, I suppose, is when I think about Monocle, I think that we're a brand that sort of harks back to 100 years ago, but we're new and we're modern. And so therefore we had an old sort of nice, warm typeface that you might find on an old, I don't know, compliment slip from an embassy somewhere from the 50s. And then we've also got this nice modern, also from the 50s, you know, sans serif, amazing typeface that just works the world over.
That leads to my next question in terms of adapting, because obviously we've stuck to a kind of course that's obviously very identifiable, but you've adapted. There's various elements that have been brought in, whether it's Helvetica or various adaptations. Maybe tell us about how you bring in new adaptations to that typography. Are the rules really strict?
Whenever you sort of expand into an extra font, it's more it just has to tonally sort of fit in with what you're doing. And when you get to the point we are, we're just closing our 79th issue, we've got sort of 8 years of experience and 8 years of building up a vernacular and aesthetic. And it's a bit like being a fashion house and every season you have to reinvent yourself, but still you have to come out of the box looking like Chanel or Gucci. And it's not like, you know, one season Gucci are tartan and the next season they're about PVC onesies. It always feels like Gucci. And so I think when we look to do any little brand extension, typeface, colour, anything like that, paper choice, it still has to feel like Monocle. It still has to come from that same kind of world. So that's always sort of there at the back of your mind when you're choosing something else. And often we'll choose something that just gives a little bit more character. It's a little bit of playfulness, I think, more than anything.
So if we kind of, for example, if you want to introduce a new type of font or a little play with a font, like you might have done on a cover recently, how would you kind of do that? Maybe talk us through where you think it's appropriate to adapt our classic plantain and Helvetica choices and kind of morph them into something a little bit different.
Well, both of those typefaces have got a lot of range. That's another reason why I chose plantain, that it's got a lot of weights and a lot of character in those weights. So there's a bold condensed version, there's a school book version, which is used, you know, in children's books. And because you've got that, you can then throw that in the mix. And it's almost like it's free. It's like you don't have to go and find a new typeface. You can just go and use the bold condensed one because that's got quite a lot of character. And, you know, bingo, you've added the little bit of flavour that you wanted on the cover. Similar, not so much so with Helvetica, but you can. You know, again, Helvetica's got a lot of weights. You can use the extended one and it feels a little bit 70s travel agent. You can use the condensed one and it, you know, it's just useful on cover lines. You can fit more information in. It's just a little bit more playing around with type in a way that you might be thinking about how you would design a logo or something like that. So often we use a different program. We're not thinking so much about typography. We're thinking more about, yeah, just making some sort of colourful little tone with it. And then beyond that, pulling in an additional font, there's only one or two we really use. And often we'll look at something that's got a nice numeral. Often on our covers, we have a lot of information. We use numerals. And there we'll just look for typefaces that have interest in nice sort of shaped numerals. And then if you're just looking at numerals, they don't really convey that much in terms of branding because it's just a number. It's not like a whole new typeface. It's just a number set. So it's just a bit more forgiving.
There's a kind of consensus, you'd say, that you're towing the line, basically, but playing around with it every so often.
Yeah, hopefully. I haven't had too many things rejected. I think with covers, it's a little game you play. You sort of have to be the same but different. It's a sort of oxymoron. It's like reinvent that, but don't change anything. So you just have to make yourself noticed and sort of do something new each time.
That was Monocle creative director Richard Spencer Powell speaking to David Pleasant on the art and challenges of looking after a magazine's typography. And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, also Adrian Shaughnessy is our guest today, and Bruno Mock. Gentlemen, just we heard, of course, from our creative director there a little bit earlier in our package, but we should probably get to the point of the program where it does exactly what it says on the label. Bruno, you've brought a much bigger stack of things, so we should probably sort of start with you. You've got the FT redesigned, rather controversial, a lot of comment. I don't know if we want to start there, and you've got many other things sort of sitting in the pile there, but I guess you've cracked open the FT there. You've always got something to say about it.
Yeah, it's the other day, and I was looking at it and think, ooh, the typeface has changed. Mm. Finally, you know, something, get away from Times New Roman. It's a good step. And the main thing that I've noticed is that finally they're using ligatures in the FT. Mm. You know, it's always bugged me that you would have an FI and an FL standing so far apart, almost breaking the words apart and obviously affecting the legibility of the typeface. And now they have resolved it in this typeface designed by Chris Sowersby from New Zealand, you know, very talented young man. And I quite like it. I really like it. It's refreshed, you know, it feels more contemporary. It feels a little bit more lively. I think, you know, just the change of the typeface makes the Financial Times, I guess, a little bit less stiff.
Mm. Adrian, a lot of the comment around the redesign of the FT has been that it's quite sharp. Before, you had a much more rounded masthead, and many have sort of said that it looks a little bit sort of spiky. Mm. When you look at the typography, it does definitely has some sharp edges. Is that okay, though, if you're the Financial Times, that, you know, maybe you need to be a bit sort of sharp and spiky? Well,
this is the aspect of typography that interests me, is how it reflects cultural trends and cultural shifts. And I think the spikiness, well, I mean, there never was a more spiky time in financial wheelings and dealings, so I suppose it is perfect. But I love this idea of typography forming a kind of map, a sort of geography or taxonomy of culture. And it's a great thing about going to a foreign country as a graphic designer. You scan the shop fronts and the signage and stuff, and you get something from it. You actually get a flavour of where you are.
Mm.
Yeah. What I'm finding wonderful is, you know, I mean, these comments about the spikiness, you know, this is, of course, all emotional content, you know, and the beauty is that science up to this day hasn't quite figured out how we are actually perceiving this, how the emotions happen. And I've been doing a little bit of studying on this, and in terms of pure legibility, the brain absolutely does not care whether it's a sans serif, a serif, or whether it's spiky.
It does not.
No, it does absolutely not. As long as the character shapes are clear and unambiguous.
Yeah. It's very interesting you bring that up, because I have a friend who's doing a PhD on this very subject. Mm. And she's a biologist, Canadian biologist. And she has a boyfriend who's a graphic designer, and she couldn't understand how he made his decisions. He would choose a typeface, and she wouldn't understand how he did it. What process did he go through? So she thought, right, I'm going to apply my biological training. So she looked at the retina and the way the eye responds, and she discovered, of course, that we think we're exercising free will, but we're not. There's a neurological and retinal response to imagery, and it's the most fascinating thing. When it's finished, it'll make a few people rethink the way we approach typography.
Oh, definitely.
I think there's a documentary that. What do you have there? You've got two titles that you brought in.
Yeah, well, I've gone to the other extreme, and I was hoping with the three that I've got, the Type Plus, which you've mentioned, and this, I was trying to show a sort of spectrum of my interests. I mean, I'm utterly promiscuous and eclectic in my taste. I kind of like everything, from the bad vernacular to the incredibly refined. I like it all. And so I brought in two things. One is from my own publishing company, and this is a book on Jurian Schroefer. And Jurian Schroefer was the most amazing. The woman who's written this book said that he was a computer designer before the computer, and he's produced these most marvelous geometric typographic compositions. Use pure type. It's like a digital book of Kells. I mean, it's the most extraordinary detailed stuff, but he did it all pre-computer.
Is the fascination with that just the precision that you get in a pre-computer era, or what is it? What would you say is sort of the attraction
there? There's a huge amount of craft gone into it. I mean, it's incredibly skillful and dexterous work, but it seems to come out of a real aesthetic sense, a sense of geometry, a sense of a real cultured sense of how you can use letter forms in a very, very expressive way. So he for me is a kind of Dutch master. He's not very well known. He's dead now. but I think he's one of the unsung greats of typography.
I mean, yeah. This is great. There are these annual report covers for Bowles, I mean, which is just brilliant.
It's fantastic.
Bruno, does it matter when you talk to a client? You know, we're so obsessed with the notion of craft today, and has it been done by hand or not or whatever. Does anyone get excited that someone really might have sat down with a grid and a pencil and then some ink to get there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It can be a selling point. You know,
it can.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, you always start off with a few hand-drawn sketches, you know, but in the end of the day, I believe, well, no one's going to pay for me, you know, to actually draw everything by hand first and then digitize it and stuff. So the craftsmanship can also happen on the computer in a digital environment. You know, there's actually no difference, you know, whether I shave Bezier points or lines on a piece of paper. Mm. It makes no difference to the quality of the product at the end.
Let's just jump into some of the other titles you've got here. Let's skip the next newspaper. Maybe let's get to some magazines or something else there.
Well, actually, I brought in a couple.
Rather old New Yorker.
Old New Yorkers from 1938. Mm. You know, the New Yorker, I've always liked the New Yorker. And if you look back, you know, these originals, you know, very austere, actually, the design, you know, very just type and a few black and white illustrations. And they've kept that for a long, long time. And I guess the New Yorker, they changed the kind of like particularly the illustrations, the black and white illustrations to color illustrations, sort of like the mid-90s, late 90s, you know, started introducing that. Probably because the readership has changed as well, and there have been different demands. But for some reason, or for that particular reason that the New Yorker is such an established magazine, they have kept, I think, the essence of what the New Yorker always has been. You know, still a very austere, a very refined typography, layout, illustration style, and of course the content, the writing, the editorial is of that similar quality.
You can imagine the readers never noticing it changing, and it, because of the changes are quite small over long periods.
Indeed, and that is actually one of the points. Back in the early 90s, I was tasked to recut all the fonts for the New Yorker when they swapped from, you know, traditional typesetting over into digital typesetting. And the task was to recut the fonts for the Macintosh environment so that the readers wouldn't see the change. So they had to look exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. What is wonderful about this issue, it's 1938. The New Yorker went through, I guess, his last major redesign was probably about 2 years ago now. But if you would have looked at a copy of even the New Yorker from the early 2000s, I mean, they're really not 1,000 miles apart. Trim size, it's a little bit taller than it was. But what is just astounding, and I would sort of advise anyone to get around to any car boot sales or garage sales to pick up some of these this weekend, because it's just the stunning amount of advertising, which is really amazing. This great ad for the New York World Telegram, and it's by, of, and for New Yorkers. Just, it's great. Facts, fiction, features, fast. And it's a wonderful celebration of print, which is great to see.
It's fabulous. And I think it's great to see that, you know, a magazine like the New Yorker, who's so specialist, can actually still survive in a printed form. People apparently thrive.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and you sort of do, lots of people sort of like what they do in a digital context, but that is still a brand which, you know, survives or not. But I think its power is what happens on page. Time for one more title, a Neue Graphic.
This is a major publishing coup, not by me, I'm embarrassed to say, because I would love to do this. I would absolutely love to do this. This is Lars Müller, the Swiss publisher, and this is his amazing reconfiguration. Not reconfiguration. It's actually a facsimile version of Neue Graphik. A Neue Graphik, for all modernists, is the mother lode. It's the moment where it all came together. A stunning publication. There was only 17 or 18 of them, I think. Lars Müller's compiled them all. He's very beautifully recreated them. I mean, they are, I shouldn't really say recreate, they're facsimile versions. They're almost identical to the originals. I have friends who have the originals, I don't. But it's the most sensitive and clever piece of publishing, because he's changed nothing. But for anybody who wants to know where the modernist motherlode is, here it is.
I mean, Bruno, just as a Swiss gentleman around the table, it's great to see when you see Steiner here, which is so famous. Anyone who looks at any construction sites around Switzerland, and that font is still there. And I'm looking. This is from 1932. Is as modern as the day it came out, and has not aged at all. This is, and I guess maybe from a Swiss point of view, maybe last word, when you look at something like this, even though you say you want things to sort of break out of this world, it's still pretty sort of fabulous. And I mean, I look at it, I see, you know, you get excited, all of the great Plakatkunst, all of the things that are in there. It's
The only thing that bothers me about Swiss typography now is, let's face it, it's a dead horse. Let's stop flogging it. It's nice to look at the old stuff, you know, but let's kind of like go to new horizons.
I was going to ask you, Adrian, then, last word to you. Do you sort of feel when you're out there in the world, just that we need to be looking for new pastures? Or is there always a time to come back to it, do you think?
The new pastures are there. There's no question. Mm. I mean, they're there in abundance. There's no question that new things aren't happening. But I think we can learn from the past. I think those Swiss guys can teach us something. I mean, in precision and in terms of pure messaging, it's unsurpassed. I mean, it's the mother load.
Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. That brings us to the end of edition 114 of The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. My special guests today have been Adrian Shaughnessy and Bruno Maga. Producer, David Pleasant, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note at info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes or SoundCloud. But for now, for me, goodbye.